Hi, this is Newt. 2020 is going to be one of the most extraordinary election years of our lifetime. I want to invite you to join my inner circle as we discuss each twist and turn in the presidential race in my members-only Inner Circle Club. You'll receive special flash briefings, online events, and members-only audio reports from me and my team. Here is a special offer for my podcast listeners. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. And if you sign up for a 1 or 2 year membership, you'll get 10% off your membership price and a VIP fast pass to my live events. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. Use the code podcast at checkout. Sign up today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast and use the code podcast. Hurry, this offer expires February 14th. On this episode of Newt's World, we're exploring the topic of electromagnetic pulse, or EMP, which could potentially be the greatest threat to our civilization, and yet many people don't know about it or understand it. An electromagnetic pulse is a super energetic wave that could be caused by an enemy attack or even the sun, and it causes electric grids to black out and shut down for an extended period of time. The net result is the life-sustaining critical infrastructure, which helps maintain modern civilization everywhere on the planet, is threatened. We'll go into more depth about EMP in this episode. I'm pleased to welcome my guests, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, who served as Chief of Staff on the Congressional EMP Commission for 17 years, and Dr. William R. Fortune, author of the best-selling EMP books, One Second After, One Day After, and The Final Day. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, would you take a couple minutes and just start with your background academically and then your involvement in national security?
Sure. I've got two PhDs, one in history and the other in strategic studies. I worked for the CIA for a decade during what I thought was the most dangerous part of the Cold War, where the decline of the Soviet Union from the peak of its military power when they were seriously considering going to war with us before they lost that power, and then into the Russian period with the collapse of the Soviet Union and then the rise of Russia. So I followed the continuity of Russian nuclear weapons and strategy from the Soviet Union into the Russian period, and now we're back in this new Cold War. And I was one of the few, when the Soviet Union collapsed, saying that they'd be back and that we had better keep our eye on that ball. Then I worked for the Congress on the House Armed Services Committee, on the professional staff as an expert on nuclear weapons strategy, weapons of mass destruction, NATO expansion. And I served on a number of congressional commissions, including the Strategic Posture Commission, which looked at modernization of U.S. nuclear forces. And we were constantly saying we should modernize them. And then the 17 years as the chief of staff of the Congressional EMP Commission. EMP is one of the top priorities that we had. After 20 years of trying, President Trump finally signed an executive order on March 26th directing the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Energy to work together to try to protect the country. The executive order hasn't solved the problem to see whether we will succeed in overcoming the resistance from the utilities and actually get the country protected.
You know, I think one of the challenges with electromagnetic pulse is it just sounds too hard. How would you explain to the average American citizen what is electromagnetic pulse?
An electromagnetic pulse is basically caused by a moving magnetic field. When you go to start your lawnmower, you know, you pull a cord on a lawnmower, you're spinning a magneto, which is a little cluster of magnets, and it causes a small magnetic field to move around. And this makes the electrons move in the coil in your lawnmower, which basically causes a small electromagnetic pulse that you can see in the form of a spark in the spark plug. Now, the Earth is a giant magnet surrounded by a magnetic field that we call the magnetosphere. And when a coronal mass ejection from the sun, traveling 1,000,000 miles an hour, slams into the magnetosphere, it moves around. If the coronal mass ejection is big enough, like the Carrington event in 1859, it'll move around everywhere in the world and cause electrons to move in wires everywhere in the world. And the powers, because we're talking about a planetary scale now, the energies are likewise scaled up to a planetary scale, and they can be enormous. They can do things like there was a geomagnetic storm, a natural EMP back in 1989 called the Hydro-Quebec storm, and it melted the extra high voltage transformer that was designed to carry 750,000 volts, and it melted in 90 seconds as a consequence. And that wasn't a superstorm. That was kind of a run-of-the-mill, more powerful than your average storm, but it wasn't a geomagnetic superstorm. Another way of thinking about EMP, everyone has actually kind of experienced this in their lives. I'm sure everyone listening has had the experience of driving down the highway, and you're listening to the radio, and you pass under a high power line, and suddenly the radio show goes off, and then when you come out, you drive away from that power line a little way, it comes back on again. Well, what happened is you passed under electromagnetic field. Now, we try to design these power lines. We put them up high enough, and we insulate them so they don't destroy your radio or they don't stop your car from running. But if you put enough energy into that field, you could destroy the radio. You could stop the car from running. So just picture a field like that, a field that could stop your car that is so big that it covers North America. That's what you could do with a nuclear weapon detonated at 300 kilometers altitude over the center of this country. You could put an EMP field down over all of North America that would cover most of Canada, all 48 United States, and a good chunk of Mexico, and destroy or put at risk all the electronic systems within that footprint. And we can't survive as a civilization without those electronic systems. Another way of thinking about EMP is that it's an anti-technology weapon. It subtracts from the equation of our civilization, technology, modern electronic technology. You know, the commission in which I served calculated that if we had a blackout that lasted 1 year in this country, we could lose up to 90% of our population through starvation, disease, and societal collapse. And that's why the Russians, the Chinese, even the North Koreans, they all know about EMP. They've incorporated it into their war plans. They would use it to try to destroy us, to try to paralyze our military capabilities in the event of a war. Sort of the ultimate asymmetric weapon.
Can you talk a little bit more about what happened in 1859? You could actually have a solar event which has the same impact as an EMP event.
The Carrington event, it's the most powerful solar storm we know of up to that time. Of course, magnetometers had been deployed for the first time in 1859 in various places around the world. So we actually got some readings on the 1859 Carrington event. What happened is that an extraordinarily powerful coronal mass ejection was thrown out of the sun. These coronal mass ejections, they're basically a chunk of the sun, superheated blob of ionized plasma, and they come out of the sunspots. And there was a sunspot aimed right at the Earth, and this thing came out. A normal geomagnetic storm, a normal coronal mass ejection, takes about 3 days to reach the Earth. But this one was so energetic and was traveling so fast, it took only 11 hours to cross the 97 million miles between the sun and the Earth and hit us. And Carrington, an observer who was looking at the sun and watching that event, he actually saw it coming. And he's the guy that made the connection between the aurora borealises that happened. They were visible in the Hawaiian Islands, for example. You could read newspapers in London at night by the light of the aurora borealis. And the primitive electronics of the day, which was the telegraph system. Telegraphs were all over the world at that point. Every place the colonial powers were located, in Africa, India, China, and of course North and South America and Europe, every place built a railroad, they also would string telegraph lines around it. So we had telegraph systems pretty much all over the world on all the major continents in 1859. And everywhere they failed. And they failed catastrophically. In some cases, the pulse was so powerful it just took over the telegraph signals so that the telegraph keys were just operating by themselves with no operator. In other cases, they sparked, and it was so intense that it burned down telegraph stations. And there were forest fires all over the world because the telegraph lines exploded.
This is all happening in response to a solar event with no human intervention. So in addition to the threat of an enemy country, there's the long-term question of how often are we going to get flares on that size? And given how much more electronic we are today, how vulnerable are we going to be to that kind of a flare?
Mother Nature almost answered that question for us back in 2012. On July 25th, 2012, NASA reported that the Earth was narrowly missed a Carrington-class coronal mass ejection, crossed the path of the Earth and just missed us by about 3 days. Had that hit, because the electric grids of the world, except in Russia and China, are basically not protected against this phenomena, electronic civilization worldwide would have come crashing down, and it would have put billions of lives at risk. NASA, after that event, estimates that the likelihood of the recurrence of something like the Carrington event is about 12% per decade, which virtually guarantees that no later than the lives of our grandchildren that we will probably experience a geomagnetic superstorm. And it's inevitable. It will happen for sure someday. It's just a question of when.
Next, Dr. Pry talks about what we can do as a nation to prevent an EMP attack. What do you think we need to do to minimize the damage that we're going to get in either a natural or a man-made electromagnetic pulse event?
The EMP Commission recommendations that were put out in 2008, you know, we basically provided a blueprint for protecting not just the electric grid, but all the life-sustaining critical infrastructures, communications, transportations, food and water. But the most important of them, of course, is the electric grid. It's the keystone critical infrastructure. Nothing else will operate without it. And even if we only protected the electric grid, if we just did that, it would give us a fighting chance to bring back the others in timely fashion so that we could avoid mass starvation. And basically, to do this, you need to install Faraday cages to protect the SCADA systems. You need to put in surge arresters and blocking devices to protect extra high-voltage transformers. We need to start designing things to be EMP hard. The utilities don't want to do anything because they make two arguments. One of the arguments is the EMP Commission is wrong and this threat isn't as great as they say. Now, they're not experts on this at all. They can't be trusted on this. They're just intellectually dishonest. And they have put out reports, including a recent report by the Electric Power Research Institute, for example, that tries to belittle the EMP threat. And when those get rebutted, and we have rebutted them, then they go the other way, and they say, well, the threat's so great, there's nothing we can do about it. It's like getting struck by an asteroid. But, you know, we've solved this problem before. Lightning is a form of EMP. In the EMP world, we call it E2 EMP. And we don't worry about lightning anymore because almost everything in our electronic civilization is protected against lightning already, with surge arresters and blocking devices and Faraday cages that are adequate for lightning. Now, they're not adequate for what we might call E3 EMP and E1 EMP. Just think of them as forms of super lightning. They're much more powerful. One of them lasts longer. The other one is much faster. Lightning lasts milliseconds, you know, a thousandth of a second, whereas the EMP shockwave that we're most concerned about, so-called E1 EMP, is a billionth of a second. It's a million times faster. And so lightning protection doesn't work against these new kinds of EMP threats that we're worried about. But we as a society, painlessly, without even thinking about it, have protected ourselves against this form of EMP called lightning. And why is that? It's because we put in place regulations and best practices and standards for hardening everything from automobiles to refrigerators and the personal computer on your desk against lightning. Your personal computer, if you look at the plug in the wall for your personal computer, it's kind of a fat plug. It's bigger than a normal plug. That's because there's a little surge arrestor for lightning in that plug. And nobody complains about it. It's just a standard thing that every country in the world does it. because lightning happens all the time. And so you have to protect our electronics against lightning. So by that same process of putting in regulations and requirements and best practices, we can protect everything eventually against EMP as well. So we've done this before, and we can prove we can do it, and it's even hardly noticeable to us.
Are the reports of your commission available, or are they classified?
Some of them are classified, but most of the unclassified reports are available on www.firstempcommission.org.
We'll put that on our show page. If you're talking to every American, what should they do?
Well, first, I think every American should be their own first line of defense. It's not clear that we're going to win the struggle to protect our critical national infrastructures. So people should be prepared. Have food, have water, think about where you live. Be your own first line of defense. This is encouraging everybody to become a survivalist. What it is encouraging is for people to sort of take responsibility for themselves the way my father's generation did, the way the great generation that survived the Great Depression and World War II did. Those people had never heard of EMP, but they had seen our government fail in peace during the Great Depression and in war, and fail catastrophically. And there was a pride that people took. It actually, I think, made for a happier people and a happier population, because they knew that if the worst happened, they could take care of their own families at least. So the first thing I'd encourage the audience to do is don't trust the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA that no matter what happens, they're going to be there in 72 hours. Be your own first line of defense. Trust yourself. And think about what would happen in a grid down event and a hurricane or any other kind of a thing. If you're prepared for an EMP, which is one of the worst case scenarios, you'll be prepared for anything. So have some kind of a supply of food and water and a plan about what your family should do if the worst happens, whether it's hunkering down or moving to share a place with relatives who live in the country. I'd contact my state representative and governor. You can harden an individual state. I've written a book called Blackout Wars that describes how you can do this legislatively. If a governor were to pass an executive order, for example, requiring the utilities that serve that state start protecting themselves, they'd have to do it. And it is possible, even if the rest of the country goes down, if you've protected the generation and distribution systems in your state, you can keep the lights on. And some states have actually started to move in that direction. Maine, for example, did it. Texas has been trying to do it for a few years. Every state, you end up having to fight the utilities that don't want to do anything. California passed a bill so that at least policy decisions have been made in the right direction.
It seems to me that the hard truth is that we're just not prepared to deal with this extensive threat to our civilization that a real electromagnetic pulse attack or that a real large solar event would represent, and that we have a real obligation to strengthen our infrastructure and our defenses against this capability. And until we do that, we are in grave danger both as a nation and as a society, and that the work you're doing, others are doing, we need to keep the pressure on Congress and on the bureaucracy to follow through and actually defend America.
Bill Fortune credits you with inspiring him to write his novel. I'm disappointed to say that all the EMP Commission reports that we wrote didn't generate as much public interest in the threat as Bill Fortune's novel, One Second After. So you and he have played at least as great a role, perhaps a greater role, than I and the whole official Congressional EMP Commission moving the country in a direction where we might get it protected.
Well, listen, thank you very much for joining us.
I thank you, Mr. Speaker, for being a leader on this issue yourself.
Next, I'm joined by Dr. William Fortune, author of One Second After. I was delighted when the first sponsor of Newt's World was Oxford Gold Group. I love entrepreneurial startups of people who are eager, willing to go out and do new and different things. And as a historian, I know that having a balanced portfolio is a very important thing. And they offer financial information and background information that I think is very helpful. So whatever you decide to do in the end, I think you'll find the information they have is really worthwhile. And that's why I'm delighted to introduce you to the Oxford Gold Group.
Most of us still remember what happened to our 401ks and IRAs back in 2008 during the financial crash. In a flash, millions of hardworking Americans lost more than half of their retirement and savings. Many of us still haven't recovered those losses, even as the stock market reached record highs. Did you know that while the stock market crashed, the price of gold and silver skyrocketed? In fact, investors who had the foresight to diversify a portion of their retirement and savings before the 2008 meltdown watched as the price of gold and silver went up over 300%. While millions of Americans lost their nest eggs in the stock market, many others were able to make gains most people had never seen before. Call the Oxford Gold Group today at 1-833-327-9472 or visit oxfordgoldgroup.com/newtsworld and request your free investor's guide. Investing in precious metals with the Oxford Gold Group is safe and secure. We tailor investment packages to suit any portfolio. Don't risk the future of your IRA, 401k, or savings on paper investments. Protect your retirement and savings with physical assets like gold and silver. Nobody knows when the next financial crisis will happen. Get prepared by talking to the Oxford Gold Group by calling 1-833-327-9472 or by visiting oxfordgoldgroup.com/newtsworld. Financial security is just a phone call away.
Would you say that One Second After is your most famous book?
Without doubt. One Second After sold about 1 million copies. It's been published in about 15 languages. It is, without doubt, has been my most successful book.
Did that surprise you?
I thought it would sell 5,000 copies. Yeah, it surprised me. It was a book that hit at the right moment, with the right audience, with the right people, including you, holding the book up and saying, it's about time we read this. The book is about an electromagnetic pulse as an offensive weapon, hits the United States. It shuts down our power grid. It doesn't come back on. Estimates are that upwards of 90% of all people would die within a year.
When I read it the first time, I was just so blown away by it. As you take that large fact, but then you carry us one step at a time through just an amazing experience. So we're there with John Matheson. We're seeing his own confusion. We're seeing the world around him falling apart. Your ability in this case to get inside the psychology of survival. It's an everyday town in North Carolina that you know because you've taught there for so many years. It's a feel for what would happen. Until I read your book, it never occurred to me that one of the side effects would be that most of our psychiatric medicines require refrigeration. And within a week or two, both people who are diabetic, who also require refrigeration, I mean, the number of different things going on that you take for granted that suddenly disappear is just amazing. And you capture that down at a personal life level.
When I was working on the novel, I went around, I interviewed a lot of people of, if the electricity goes off, what happens to you? What happens to your job? And I went to my pharmacist, sat down with her over a cup of coffee after she closed the store. And at the end of an hour, she was crying. She started running down the list of all the different types of situations. Some of them would prove to be fatal in less than a week, let alone issues like painkillers, things like that. The other one I went to interview was the nursing home. My father was in a nursing home at the time. He was fighting at the last months of his life. And not many people realize a couple million people in those homes, the medication is delivered only 2 or 3 days in advance because of the opioid crisis and such. But what happens if it stops? What's going to happen to all the people with Alzheimer's? So what I tried to do was reduce it from this massive catastrophe like we have today with too many movies and books and things blowing up and taking it all the way back to just a basic story about a family, call it Leave of the Beaver type family, who suddenly things go bad, really bad, and then what will they do in order to survive?
John Matheson becomes a really remarkable figure, which ultimately you carry out through three different books.
At the end of the foreword to the book, I said, I hope this never happens. I hope 30 years from now my name is forgotten, because if so, it worked. If the country woke up, we got better prepared, and it never happened.
You know, I have to ask you, when you dedicated the first book, One Second After, to your daughter, did you ever think much about the danger of her having to live in a world after an EMP strike?
Well, that's what started it. My daughter she was 10 or 11 at the time, and I peeked in the door, and I broke down crying. I right there on the spot, I started to cry, because I knew I had done nothing to protect her. Nobody was doing anything to protect her. And then that's the genesis of the book. If you know your enemy is strong enough to beat you, you will never dare launch an attack. The temptation to attack comes when you start to think, you know, I can take him out. And I can take him out big time. With EMP, third-rate players like Korea, Iran, for quite a long time, had that temptation dragged in front of them. They could literally destroy the United States in 30 minutes. And then as we start to build back up, we will cross a line where don't even think it. You even think it and you're gone. That's what it's going to take to prevent it.
You've now done three novels on the EMP effect and its aftermath. What sort of things did you do to get yourself into the rhythm and the mood to fully be able to express this?
With EMP, one of the basic things is simply go for 3 or 4 days without any electricity, none, zero. See what it's like. See how much you don't like it after but 6 hours, and then imagine being in that situation for several years. The most fundamental thing of our society today is electricity. To the people of 130 years ago, not so. But the people of today, we can't even think about it. In that first 30 seconds, several hundred thousand people are just going to die because the airplanes they are on are useless. With the computer capacity shut off, even if you got Sully up front, that plane's going to go down like a rock. First 3 to 5 days, nursing homes, people with Alzheimer's, a lot of people, they have those ankle bracelets that Alzheimer people wear. If they get near a door, it locks. In safe mode, that deactivates. What are you going to do with that? All these people at nursing homes that nobody's taking care of. Gastrointestinal illness will start in because of water purification, just getting water itself. Average town has 20, 25 days worth of food. Then that runs out, and then it gets bad. At which point as well, you all have had millions upon millions fleeing the cities with this fantasy that things in the country are going to be good. Or, for example, hunting. Oh, we'll all go out, we'll just hunt, we'll get a deer. But how many people have actually killed and cut up a deer into usable food? At the end of a year, most of us will be dead.
We've now had well over a half century to understand this and to develop a solution to it. So what do we have to do then?
If they know that we are robust and that we have a foreign policy and a leader that says don't even think about it, isn't that going to lower the chances right there? That means spending the money to start hardening the system. Hardening it meaning taking a surprise hit in which the majority of the system survives, will require some money. Now, Dr. Peter Pry, a brilliant man, says $2 to $5 billion to harden our system, meaning put in better resistors, better energy exchangers and such. That's nothing in terms of federal budget. Step two, raising public awareness. We have to, with realistic material, raise public awareness as to what EMP is, Why there's a threat, why it has to be paid for. Third, anti-ballistic missile. Our system's somewhat antiquated. We're starting to build better systems. We got to build instant reaction that can shoot systems down seconds after they're detected. And the fourth one, we have to have a foreign policy that says if we find you not only are thinking of doing it, you're really going to do it, we'll do you first. And preemptive first strike. Because there ain't going to be any room for a return strike after it hits us.
I've been involved in the threat from electromagnetic pulse for many, many years. I focus on this issue because it's one of the few that could literally end our civilization. As Bill Fortune proves in his novel, One Second After, a truly effective EMP attack would shatter electric production everywhere. And that means, for example, if your car happens to be on, it would shatter your car's ability to function. It means that you wouldn't have any electricity for your refrigerator. It has all sorts of implications. And I thought that it was very important that we take this seriously because I know that the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, and the North Koreans are all trying to develop an offensive capacity to launch an EMP attack. I think we have to fortify our infrastructure. I've testified in front of the Senate to that effect. I think that we have to take it very seriously, and we have to methodically prepare ourselves as a country so that we could survive an EMP attack. And frankly, if you look at the Carrington event from 1859 and you think about what the sun could do, you want a nation which is designed to survive a massive solar wave that would otherwise close down virtually all of our operating systems. So I think it's a very important topic. I'm delighted you listened, and I hope you'll talk to your congressman and your senator about why it's important that America deal with EMP before there's a crisis. Thank you to my guests, Dr. William R. Fortune and Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You can read more about electromagnetic pulse and order Fortune's best-selling books, One Second After, One Day After, and The Final Day, by visiting our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Westwood One. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers, and our producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our editor is Robert Borowski, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. Our guest booker is Grace Davis. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. The music was composed by Joey Salvia. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360 and Westwood One's John Wardock and Robert Mathers. Please email me with your comments at newt@newtsworld.com. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. On the next episode of Newt's World, we're interviewing the author of the new book, Our Broken America, Why Both Sides Need to Stop Ranting and Start Listening, with my guest and my daughter, the author Jackie Gingrich Cushman.
We hear so many negative things about our nation today, and that's quite frankly a challenge for us, and I think we really need to change our national dialogue. Yes, we have problems. I'm not saying we don't have problems, but if we're constantly beating ourselves up as a nation, it's no wonder that we don't make much progress.
I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World. The Westwood One Podcast Network.